Hello, welcome to the Netzpolitik.org podcast. We're at Republika 2014, and our guest today is Andrei Zolotov. Hey, Andrei, you're an investigative journalist in Russia and an expert on Russian security services. Andrei, briefly explain who you are, where you're from, what you've done, how you came to be a journalist.
I started my journalistic career back in 1996. I've been covering Russian secret services for more than 14 years, starting in 1999. And in 2000, my colleagues and me, we launched a website called Agentura.ru, which is a watchdog on Russian secret services. And we tried all this time to make Russian secret services more transparent. And, so I'm an investigative journalist, and for the last 14 years, I reported counterterrorism operations, terrorist attacks, espionage scandals, and lately, I was mostly focused on surveillance and mostly on Russian surveillance. We broke story about almost totalitarian surveillance at the Olympic Games in Sochi, and about Russian telecommunication interception systems called SORM, so that kind of thing.
All right, impressive work. You already mentioned the website and project Agentura.ru. What exactly is it? How is it organized? Who is it? What do you do?
When we launched this website back in 2000, we thought to model it after a very famous American project called FAS, Federation of American Scientists Secrecy Project, run by Stephen Aftergood. And our idea was then to use freedom of information requests and journalistic sources to try to build a picture about Russian secret services. Well, to be frank, very quickly we understood that we cannot do the same thing that is done by Stephen Aftergood in the United States, because the circumstances in Russia and the United States are so different, and you cannot get information from secret services in the same way, and Freedom of Information Act. We have this act in Russia, but you can't use it. And also, back in 2000, we believed that we can unite efforts of many journalists who were active in the area of reporting secret services, and we dreamed of uniting thousands of people based in Moscow and in regions, because Russian secret services are quite active in regions, and we thought that would be important. But we ended up by the mid of 2000s with the staff of only two people. So it seems that we developed our project, but instead of growing, we lost some journalists, and now it's extremely difficult to find journalists who might report about secret services in Russia at all.
Well, what are the biggest successes you've had with Agentura.ru?
Well, I think the latest one is this story about surveillance at Sochi, which we broke in The Guardian. Story about SORM. Before that, we broke some stories about terrorist attacks and hostage takings, and how secret services handled these crises. And we also wrote a book about the secret services in Russia in 2010. It was published in the United States and was translated into seven languages.
And what are the difficulties you had? You already said that you were trying to grow, but are back to two people, which is, if I'm informed correctly, you and your wife. What are the problems you're having? And also, you had a little affair with the rather well-known newspaper Novaya Gazeta, but it only lasted for 2 years. What happened there?
Yeah, to be frank, we thought when we joined the Novaya Gazeta in 2006, we already understood that it would be the last Russian newspaper which I would accept our stories about secret services, because already by 2006 it was quite clear that we got self-censorship in Russian media, and editors are not very happy with this kind of investigations. And it was in 2009, I think, Novaya Gazeta, even Novaya Gazeta, which, as you know, Anna Politkovskaya worked for this newspaper. But anyway, many things changed, and in 2009, even Novaya Gazeta was not ready to publish sensitive investigations about secret services.
You've mentioned Anna Podkovskaya. She was a Russian journalist who was actually murdered on the street. So in the US, journalists like Grant Greenwald and whistleblowers, like the well-known ones we had on the internet recently, are threatened with death penalty or long-term imprisonment. In Russia, investigative journalists actually die. So how do you work in an environment of fear like that? Where do you get your courage from?
Well, maybe the biggest problem with the pressure we face in Russia is nobody actually understands the rules. Nobody actually understands what might be allowed by the authorities, what might be not allowed. So that's why we got a big deal of self-censorship among journalists. And I, to be frank, I think this is the main problem, because for many, they just try to guess how these stories might be taken by the Kremlin or by some other minor government organizations. And I personally, I hate self-censorship. I think it's a problem which with every journalist faced with. It might happen everywhere, not only in Russia. In Russia, it's maybe more acute. But I just hate this thing, and I believe in professional, sorry for to say these banal things, but I believe in professional standards of journalism. And my defense, always, all the time, when I was interrogated by the Russian secret services or pressured, my defense was just to say, well, I try to comply with journalist standards. I never take sides. I never try to be, say, an activist. I never try to be a leader of something. I'm a journalist, and I wanted to report the story honestly and objectively. And, well, it's not very easy, but anyway, I still try.
Well, you say it like it's only journalism, but you're speaking the truth in an environment that doesn't always want, especially investigative news stories, to be published at all. You mentioned you had your offices searched, you were questioned by the FSB. How do you cope with that? Where do you take your courage from?
Thank God we live in the global world, actually, and I have many friends in different countries. And for me, it's extremely important to have support from these people, just moral support. And sometimes it's even in practical sense, it's a very good thing, because when you are contacted by secret services and they try to play with you, your best defense is to make this thing public, to report that you are summoned for interrogation, you are questioned, or your offices are searched. And I always made these things public, and I always asked my friends and my colleagues in news agencies and newspapers in Russia or abroad to report these stories, because it's not about fame, it's about about protection. Because in this case, security services understood that you are not the guy they might play with. You are not ready for the game. That's a very important thing. And to be frank, I talk about this with many journalists based in different countries, and many of them, they told me the same thing. But the best protection is to make these stories public. And so I think it's still the best protection. So in this case, I should say that I rely on support and encouragement of my colleagues, which might be based in Russia and might be based abroad.
Agentura Aru is publishing in Russian and English?
Before, yeah, we try to get some story translated in English, and some stories we actually write in English, because now the circumstances are so tough in Russia that if I and my colleague want to have story published in Russia, first I need to get it published in the West. And only after that, some Russian media might be brave enough to translate this story into Russian. This happened with our story about Sochi. We first broke it in The Guardian, and only after that it was translated into Russian. The same thing happened with our story about SORM, about internet filtering in Russia, which was firstly reported in The Wired and then picked up by Russian media.
But so you actually have the facts, you write an article in Russian, but publishers say, no, this is too risky for us, we cannot do it unless it's already been in the West?
Yeah, something like that. Well, sometimes it's very complicated. Sometimes, for example, Russian journalists now are very short of commentators who might comment on security things. So they tried to call me and ask me to provide some comments about something that happened right now. And they always try to present me as an expert, not a journalist. And of course I hate these things because I'm a journalist, I'm not a security expert. And instead I try to say to them, well, if you think that you, if you value so much my comments, why don't you suggest me to write a story for you? And they told me, no, well, your comments are a good thing because it's just a line. And it's absolutely different about this story. So you see, it's a pretty tricky thing.
You've mentioned a book you published in 2010. It's called The New Nobility, The Restoration of Russia's Security State and the Enduring Legacy of the KGB. What did you actually uncover in that book?
Well, we tried to write a story about the Russian secret services in the 1990s and 2000s. And we tried to reply to the question how we actually ended up in a situation that after almost 20 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we still have the secret services, which are very proud to be successors of the KGB, which maintain many procedures, even terminology, which they inherited from the Soviet past. Especially because we are here and we are supposed to talk about surveillance. If you look into terminology we still use for surveillance, we still use Soviet terminology. That actually was one of the methods for us when we tried to understand how many countries in the former Soviet Union still stick to the Russians and try to use the same equipment, it's the same procedures. For us, one of the ways to understand that we are still close to Russia is to check whether they still use Russian terminology. Because it's Soviet terminology, mostly adopted in the 60s and 70s, and in many countries it turned out they still use these things, like special names for the departments, special terminology for the operations, nothing new. And that was our goal, just to understand how we ended up in such a strange situation.
But the title, The New Nobility, seems to suggest that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was kind of a period where every political institution and also the secret services were kind of looking for answers on their entire existence, reorganizing. But the nobility seems to suggest that they've made it up back to the top of the state and right on every big decision that is done, that is decided in Russia.
Well, actually, it's even worse. First thing, the new nobility is not coined by us. It was first mentioned and used by the director of the FSB. So he actually called his people the new nobles of Russia. The problem is that she's actually not very well understood in the West, is that the KGB was a very powerful organization, of course, in the Soviet Union, but it was under strict control of the Communist Party. Because the Communist Party, Politburo, and all these people, they were very frightened to give powers to the KGB because they wanted to prevent the repetition of the Stalinist purges. That's why they tried to keep the KGB under control. What we got under Putin, it might be the first time, not might be, but it's the first time in the history of our country, about the guy who was a trained intelligence agent got to power. Before him, there was no Soviet leaders who were trained intelligence agents. They're all from engineer background or from some political circles, but not from the KGB. Vladimir Putin is the first who is actually from the KGB. He's a trained guy and trained by the KGB. He maintains his mentality and he promoted people with the same mentality to high positions in the state. And it's very frightening because these people are not very good at understanding the world outside the barracks. You should remember that in times of the KGB and now in the time of the FSB and other secret services of Russia, new people, students or recruits, they are still trained in barracks. They actually live in barracks and they don't actually understand what's going on outside. That's why they are so susceptible to these paranoid and conspiracy theories about that everything is controlled by some CIA plots. That's why we got this remark from Vladimir Putin that the internet itself was actually invented as a CIA project and still is a CIA project. It actually reflects this mentality.
So actually, would you say that the secret services in Russia now have even more power than they ever had in the Soviet Union,
yeah,
but they're still mentally tinier focused, they don't have a big picture?
Absolutely, yeah, because there is no party control in Russia, there is no parliamentary control of the secret services, there is no public control of the secret services. We have direct access to Putin, and because we all share the same mentality, we all talk the same language. And it's extremely dangerous because there is no check and balance system. There is no one who might say these people, guys, you are becoming paranoid. You need to check this information. You need to think about political consequences of your decisions. That's the problem.
So back then they were under party control and now they're under no control?
No.
Oh, wow. So in the book you also talked about some actions the secret services, mostly FSB, but also others, were doing in foreign countries, things like assassinations and hacking.
Yeah, that's right.
Being on an internet conference, we're especially interested in the hacking parts. What actions have you uncovered in your book?
We try to understand the nature of ties between secret services and so-called patriotic hackers. You will remember we got a series of hacking attacks on neighboring countries like Estonia, Lithuania and Georgia in the late of the 2000s. And the question was who were actually in charge of these operations, how all these things were organized. What we understood is was a very surprising thing. Here I should talk very cautiously because I'm not insider, I'm outsider. So maybe I don't know some information. But as far as we understood, not the secret services, but political organizations very close to the administration of the president, so to speak, to the Kremlin, were behind this attack. I think one of the explanations is that these hacking operations were technically very, very simple. You don't need technical advice from secret services if you need to carry out DDoS attack. You might use very simple things, you might buy something on the market. That would be enough. And at the same time, it helps you to deny responsibility if something gone wrong. And that actually happened in case of Estonia. The Estonian Minister of Defense firstly claimed that the Russian secret services were behind this attack, and later he was forced to admit that there was no proof. Only, I think, maybe 2 years passed, sometime passed, when one guy from the youth organization supported by the Kremlin stepped and said something like, I was behind this attack. In this case, you see that it was political organization, not secret services. We uncovered only one case when the FSB tried to get in contact with hackers, but it was so amateurish and stupid. Anyway, we actually, for example, we tried to contact not hackers, but the guy who made a mirror of the hacker's site. And they called him, asked some stupid questions about how patriotic is he, and is he is really, in support of the Kremlin, and maybe he might help them to carry out some attacks. So the guy actually reported this stuff on his blog, and I spoke to him, and he told me this whole story. It was so stupid that secret services, they believed that he was behind these things and they failed to understand that that was just a mirror. So you see, they were not very smart by, say, late 2000s. Of course, many things happened afterwards. But I still believe that secret services are not, Russian secret services, are not very good in working with hacker community in Russia. There is still a distance between hacker community and secret services. Mostly because hacker community are quite afraid that someday the FSB might go after them. So they might use them one day, and the other day they might try to prosecute them. So that's why they still keep distance.
That's pretty interesting. Before the interview, you mentioned that the book was actually published, translated to English first and published in the US first, before it was ever published in Russian?
Actually, it was written in English because we had no hopes that it might be published in Russian. So that's why from the beginning we thought that we need to write it in English. Just because, in this case you might imagine your audience, and it's better to write the book if it's aimed at a particular audience, so it's better to write in this language. Just because it's mentally, it's more easy. because you can imagine the things. And but yes, we were surprised, but the year passed, and in 2011 one small Russian publisher bought the license and published the book in Russian. Immediately the printing house was raided by the FSB. It was quite strange again, because not the publisher, but the printing house was raided. And people inside were asking some stupid questions, something like, who actually paid for the printing of the book? And of course we said, well, the publisher paid. So, well, what was the question? And they reported back to the publisher. Publisher told me, and we made the story public. And it helped us to counter this kind of pressure. But because it coincided with the time of the protest in Moscow, it was 2011-2012.
The anti-government protests after the elections.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Well, the book became a bestseller, and, well, so I was quite happy with this coincidence.
Well, cool. So, but that was, the book was 2010 and 2011 in Russian. Since then, a lot of things have happened in the global community. One of your topics you've been working on is internet censorship. And internet censorship in Russia is a case of its own. You did some exposés on Agentura analyzing the blacklist. Would you briefly explain what the new or the internet censorship law from November 2012 changed and how things have developed since then, and what all now, what websites are blocked now, censored now in Russia?
Yeah. The problem is that before 2012, internet in Russia was relatively free. We didn't have any kind of internet filtering system. We did have some sort of the first version of blacklist. It was the blacklist of sites which were forbidden and banned by court because of extremist materials. But it was not actually technically it was not very I might say efficient, because in some regions the same site might be blocked, in some regions it would be absolutely available.
But extremism meaning mostly Islamists in Chechnya?
Yeah, it's mostly about these things. It's also about some rightist parties which might say some wild things. Anyway, it was not so important, because it was only for tiny websites. What we got in 2012, it was absolutely different thing, because we got the internet filtering system introduced nationwide, on nationwide level. And what we got with this system is the law was defined in such a way that global platforms like Google became frightened that the whole services like YouTube might be banned because of one rulic, one video, just because there was a special rule about IP address that you might be.
It has happened before, right?
Yeah, and actually it has happened. So that's why what we got. We got the internet filtering system on nationwide basis, and also we get DPI, defect inspection. And DPI, as you know, it's not only about filtering, but it's also about surveillance. Because DPI helps you to analyze traffic and identify those who talk about some specific things. And we thought then, in 2012, that the idea of the Russian authorities would be to use these kind of technologies, like DPI, to monitor and to spy on people on the internet. Surprisingly, we were wrong in our prognosis. What we got in 2013 and now in 2014, that the Russian authorities always rely on very brutal methods of pressure on websites and on global and local platforms. We always intimidated them that everything might be blocked unless you cooperate with us. So by April of 2013, all global platforms, I mean Twitter, Facebook and Google, started to remove content deemed harmful by Russian authorities in a matter of hours without court decision. What we got after
before
that...
Before a court decision.
Yes, without court decision. What we got after that, we got... I should say that firstly, the system of internet filtering was introduced ostensibly to protect children. But it was just a pretext. In fact, now we got, instead of one blacklist, we got four blacklists in Russia. So there is one blacklist with court decisions about extremist material. There is another one about child pornography and pedophiles. There is a third one, it's about copyright issues. And the last one we got just in this February, and this list consists of sites which were blocked without warrant, without court decision, just because General Prosecutor Office found some evidence that there is an information on this website with calls to go to manifestations. And also, just recently we got the report that actually we are talking about not about 4 blacklists, but about 5 blacklists, because the last one is a blacklist of hosting companies. And now you should think twice not only about what you publish online, but also about what company you choose to host your server. Because if this particular company is not very cooperative with Russian authorities, the whole service might be blocked.
And block the entire IP range?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
They tipped off everybody, but you need to be very careful. And it's better to be hosted in Russia, because in this case, you would not be blocked just because you host your site on this particular hosting service. And of course, it created the very specific atmosphere on the internet. Everybody now try to guess what might be next, because we got the new legislation almost every month. Just last week, we got new law, which actually requires bloggers to get registered. The same law requires global platforms to store their data on Russian soil, and nobody can understand what does it mean. Because if you put this directly, it might mean that Facebook and Google and Twitter should store their data on Russian soil, which should mean that they should relocate their servers to Russia. And of course, it's very frightening. And the problem is that there is no stoppage of this thing. There is no end in this new and repressive measures on the internet, and everybody is very afraid, and becoming very cautious, and that's why, as a result, we got a lot of self-censorship online.
You've mentioned quite a few topics. Now let's stay at the nationalizing hosting. So even some countries like Germany and Brazil, or some politicians of those countries, after the Snowden revelations, said, yeah, international companies like Facebook, Google, and the Prism companies can't host everything in US control, so we want to have them in our country hosting the data to fall under data protection. But in countries like Russia, that's the total opposite. So if the content is stored only in Russia, then the services have absolute direct access to it. So that's actually making things worse, not better, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because actually in the law they openly admitted that we need this service to be, this data be stored on Russian soil to make this data available for the Russian secret services. There's a line about this.
It says that, so we want our own Prism.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
wow.
Right. And so that's why when the Russian authorities speak about national sovereignty on the net and on the internet, we should understand what it is all about. It's about how to make global platforms transparent for the Russian secret services.
Oh, wow.
Also, you've mentioned some pretty weird examples of internet censorship, like entire IP ranges of hosters. YouTube was blocked because of one video.
Yeah, that's right.
And now websites with calls for demonstrations. That was news to me, but there are dozens, hundreds of more examples of things that are blocked that are absolutely absurd. Do you have some more examples?
Yeah. So, for example, if you look into official statistics of how many sites are blocked in Russia, it would be about 2,000-3,000 sites. In fact, it's about 40,000. And the problems, the differences might be explained by the fact that we got so many sites blocked on IP. And so that so many sites just, well, they suffer just because they use the same IP. And we also have a problem that instead of pressuring internet service providers, the Russian authorities decided to pressure and to put more and more pressure on, say, institutions providing public access to the internet. That's why we got raids of libraries, on internet cafes, on universities, and even post offices and schools. And we got a very weird example when one school in a very distant region of Tuva was raided twice, and the director of the school was fined the first time because he failed to install internet filtering software, and second time he was fined because the software he installed was not able to block some particular pages, and well, of course it was not his problem, but nevertheless he was fined. And this happens everywhere, and again it helps the forces to instigate more self-censorship on people. Now everybody in the schools try to guess what might be the next, and we try to control these things, and that's why we even got some really exotic ideas. For example, the idea of establishing the whitelist of sites, the sites which would be specifically approved. And so it's not about that something should be banned. It's about that something should be first approved to be accessible.
That's a serious proposition of politicians in Russia?
Yeah, actually, yes. Oh, wow. This kind of stuff was firstly suggested to some universities. And when I heard about this thing, actually it was actually announced by the Russian official at the OSCE meeting in Vienna a year ago. So but we need now think about the whitelist.
That's crazy. You've mentioned that the blocking is done via deep packet inspection, and
sometimes, because that's the problem, because deep packet inspection might be a very evil technology, but it's a sophisticated technology, so that's why you don't need to block IP. You might block not the whole site, you might block a particular page. The problem is that it's an expensive technology, and for many ISPs in Russia, it's too expensive. So that's why we just block everything.
But back in 2012, when you wrote about the internet censorship law, you also, for me, publicly exposed the so-called SORM system,
yeah,
which is, as I understand it, a nationwide surveillance deep packet inspection system.
No, it's not about deep packet inspection. It's
about SORM
is a national communication interception system. It includes, it's actually was defined in the late 1980s. In the Soviet times, and firstly to deal with, it was aiming to deal with traditional telephone conversations. Then it was constantly updated, and in the early 2000s it was updated to deal with the internet, and laterly with VoIP and with the internet and with social networks, etc. But it's in the core, it's about communication interception, and it's a very intrusive thing. It's actually, when we are talking about PRISM here, I should say that the Russian system of communication was from the beginning built in a way as to have PRISM. So actually, PRISM made the American system closer to the Russian approach. So in this case, I don't know, maybe they were inspired in some way by Russian example, but actually we ended up in the same thing. We ended up with remote access to service of internet service providers and telecom operators when telecom operators have no knowledge what's going on their servers. And the Russian system was from the beginning built in this way.
So how much of the Russian communication, you mentioned the three parts, telephony, internet, and then VoIP and other digital communication, how much of Russian communication does SORM actually surveil, store? You also wrote that it stores contents for 3 years at least.
Yeah, it depends on the content and depends on data. So if we are talking about user data, yes, and metadata, we store these things for 3 years. I don't have exact information about the content of conversations. It's a bit not so clear because it's considered to be secret. We know for sure from statistics we obtained from the Supreme Court that the number of conversations and emails intercepted by SORM doubled in 6 years. We know it for sure. But these statistics includes only, it's actually about, it's about, well, actually, in Russia, if you need to intercept someone, you can use two procedures. One thing is to intercept something with the aim to send the case to the court. So you just investigate criminal activity. And these kind of things was counted in the statistics. So if you're talking about something with the perspective to send the case to the court, so we have this data. But also we have in Russia the special cases of so-called counterintelligence activity. So someone might be intercepted because there is a special counterintelligence activity, counterintelligence operation, and we cannot obtain any kind of statistics about how many interceptions were conducted because of these counterintelligence activities. This might be bigger. Problem is, we have no information. It's all considered to be top secret.
Okay, but the understanding is that the Western Five Eyes secret services, they get pretty much every communications, every email, every phone call, every SMS, every digital communication. There's no estimation what the Russian secret services are capable of.
Well, I think their capability quite, in a way, they might be, yeah, they are very impressive. The problem is, I don't quite understand their capabilities in terms of storing intercepted data. It's one of the biggest problems for all these intelligence organizations. Where to store this data, because it's actually huge. You need to build special facilities. And it's in Russia, it's very difficult to find this kind of information. There were some rumors, but I don't think it's comparable with NSA. But in terms of their capabilities to intercept every phone call or every email, they're capable of that.
They are capable of intercepting everything. Yeah, we just don't know for sure whether they are actually saving all.
Yes, that's right.
Right now, in the last 11 months, we've learned a lot about the so-called Five Eyes, about the Western secret services, but it sometimes makes it seem like they're the worst secret services in the world. The problem only is that we don't have a lot of data, a lot of documents of countries like, at least China is pretty much, I'd guess, trying to do the exact same thing as the US and UK are, and I would guess Russia would really like to do that too.
Yes, absolutely. The problem is that it seems to me that we have some distortion in global debate over surveillance, because everybody believes that the biggest threat is posed by the United States, just because everybody uses software or services produced by the States. We all tend to use Facebook and Twitter, but nobody beyond the borders of Russia or former Soviet Union would, say, use ContactE or Weibo. That's a problem. So these problems are mostly local in the approach. But for these countries, for citizens of these countries, it's nevertheless a very big problem. Also, we need to remember that in some specific areas of surveillance, even these countries like China and Russia might be specifically very good. I would, for example, just one thing is that Russia now is a world leader in speech and speaker recognition. And Russian companies were able to sell this stuff to Mexico, to Ecuador, to Colombia, to the Middle East, and they're extremely good at these technologies. Even the FBI got interested. So you need to look into some specific areas, and surprisingly, you might find that Russians and Chinese might be better in these areas than, say, Americans.
Is that part of the research you've done with Privacy International and the Citizen Lab,
Russia's surveillance
state?
Yeah, that's right. We try to understand what's going on with the Russian surveillance experts. Because part of the debate, actually it started with the revolution in Egypt when British surveillance technologies were discovered at the offices of Mukhabarat. The problem is that it's quite possible to understand how to control surveillance experts if these technologies are produced in the West and sold to repressive regimes. It's much more difficult to understand the situation, to control this kind of expos, if these technologies are produced by repressive regimes and sold to repressive regimes.
So what are some of the key revelations you've done in the research with PI?
Well, the biggest revelation was about this company, which is a world leader in speaker recognition technologies. Because the problem with these things is what is not immediately understood is when you buy technologies you are not familiar with, say speaker recognition technology, very quickly you understand that you also need advice how to use these technologies. Very quickly you invite some, say, advisors from this company, and they help you to reform your law enforcement. And
And your laws.
Yeah, and the laws. It was one of the striking examples. Like, Mexico bought these systems from Russia, and they wanted to understand how to better to use these speaker and speech recognition technologies. And of course, the best thing to is if you need to recognize not voice, but speaker, you need to have and collect voice samples of your population. I was told by my sources that on Russian advice, in many Mexican states, now it's obligatory to give you your voice sample if you need to get your driving license.
Wow.
So that's why now they have, well, millions of voice samples. Well, it makes things better for law enforcement. They might identify people, well, maybe more efficiently, but you might understand the danger.
That's crazy. Recently, on Putin TV, Snowden was allowed to ask the Prime Minister a question whether Russia does actually analyze or surveil millions of people, and Putin quite frankly said, no, we don't have a mass system of such interception, and according to our law, it cannot exist. What's your take on that?
Well, as always, with Putin, he said half true, half lie. He said something like, our capabilities are not comparable with the Americans. That's true, as I said, because nobody uses Russian social networks, say, in the United States. But in terms of mass surveillance, the Russian secret services have capabilities, which was proved during the Olympics, when we got documentation that the Russian secret services collected metadata on all participants of the games, including judges, athletes, and journalists. And this data would be stored for 3 years. It's quite obvious that we have system of mass surveillance collection of this kind of data. Also, he said something about the court decision. The problem is that Russian secret services, they actually, according to the law, that's right, they are requested to get a court warrant. The problem is, and these things Vladimir Putin failed to mention, is that the Russian secret services has no right to show this warrant to anyone outside of the secret services. So that's why Russian, say, internet service provider have no right to ask for the warrant, and that's why we don't know what's going on these servers.
That's also one thing we learned about the NSA revelations, that the FISA court actually does give a warrant, but that is not for one target of surveillance, but for a program like PRISM.
Yeah. That's why I said that PRISM actually made the American approach closer to the Russian approach.
So recently Putin also said the internet first appeared as a special CIA project. What did he mean by that, and what? How is it relevant?
Well, the problem is that, as I said, the KGB was not very good at analysis. There was a striking difference between the CIA and KGB back in the time of the Cold War. CIA was always given the task to produce analysis, and KGB was always derived of its right, and Politburo and the Communist Party was allowed to provide analysis based on raw material gathered by the KGB. That's why these people from the KGB were not very good in understanding the picture. That's why in their picture, we don't see details. We don't see, say, difference between military and intelligence. So that's why for them, Pentagon or CIA is the same thing. They don't see as a factor of the time. So that's why if something, say, Pentagon happened to develop the internet, say, 30 years ago, for Putin, it means that still Pentagon is behind the internet. So that's why conspiracy theories are so widely popular among Russian secret services. To me, a very good example of this kind of mentality. Many inside of Russian secret services still believe that Osama bin Laden attacked New York on 9/11, funded and directed by the CIA. Just because CIA funded the same jihadin back in the 1980s, which were funded also inhabited by Osama bin Laden. So you see, these people, they don't see details. They just see, well, something closer to this thing, and that would be enough for them to make conclusions.
Might a remark like that from Putin also try to help him renationalize the internet and make it not a project of the CIA but of the FSB?
Yes, but I think it was, in this case, not this remark, but the previous remark was more important. You remember this, when Snowden asked his question, Vladimir Putin, before this question, it was a big interview conducted by Vladimir Putin for hours, maybe for 3 hours, I don't remember exactly. And 5 or 6 minutes before Snowden was allowed to ask his question, Putin was asked by a Russian journalist why he addressed his Crimea speech about the annexation of Crimea not to Western governments, but to Western peoples. And he said a remarkable thing. He said, I addressed Western peoples because I believe that today many Western governments and many Western countries lost their national sovereignty. And now it's extremely hard to talk to Western officials because they whisper at home because they are afraid of U.S. eavesdropping. So it was a direct reference to Snowden's revelations. He tried to exploit Snowden revelations to promote his ideas of national sovereignty and to send this message to the West, saying something like, well, you need to maybe to cooperate closely to Russia, something like that. So you see, this was a very direct reference to Snowden's revelations. For Russian policy, for Russian foreign policy, Snowden and his revelations were extremely useful. And all the time, since it started in spring of 2013, we tried to exploit his revelations to make an argument with the West.
How?
Well, it's a long story, but Russian authorities developed ideas of national sovereignty on the internet first in December of 2012 and tried to announce their ideas and propose these ideas at the International Telecommunication Union Summit at Dubai. And you remember that they spectacularly failed. Anglo-Saxon countries and Western European countries, they decided not to support them. But nevertheless, what was missed by many, more than 80 countries supported Russian ideas. African countries, China, many countries in Latin and South America. Anyway, so it was the situation, but it seemed that many countries which actually were behind development of the internet decided to not to support Russia. At the same time, many countries which felt, well, in an easy position, and they wanted to support Russia. And then we got Snowden, and immediately Russian officials started talking about protection of personal data of Russian citizens and put pressure on global platforms. Google came under attack, Facebook came under attack. We got some wide ideas about that we need to ban Facebook unless Facebook relocate its service to Siberia, because it helps to develop Siberian region, and also it would help to minimize cost on Siberian region might be very good to have the service of Facebook. So it's and internationally, just 10 days ago, we got Netmundiale. And Russian Minister of Communication Nikiforov, he went to Brazil again to talk about Russian ideas of national sovereignty. So they always try to use these kind of arguments.
Now, Snowden is still in Moscow and his future is uncertain. Do you have an impression that the Russian authorities are actually using him there? Or what's your take on why he's allowed to stay there?
Well, that's very difficult question. What we should remember that Snowden never met any Russian journalist, never conducted any, never granted any interviews to Russian journalists, and he was quite active online. He posted so many videos, he took part in many video conferences, but not in Russia. In Russia it was impossible to talk to him. It means that he was heavily protected, or maybe not allowed to talk to people who are actually based in Moscow, because in this case it might help to understand his conditions and his circumstances. His lawyer, Anatoly Kucherena, Russian lawyer. He's very close to the FSB. He's actually a member of the public council of the FSB. So again, it puts Snowden in a very difficult situation. I think that, and that's why so many were pissed off with his question to Putin. And for many, it was a mark that Snowden was actually played by the Kremlin and used by the Kremlin to promote Putin, etc. I think that it actually doesn't matter whether he was asked to ask this question or not. I think that Snowden used this opportunity and he asked it a very good question. I think it's a very positive thing because it helps us to start debate about surveillance in Russia. I don't think national debate, but international debate. Now we might talk not only about NSA or GCHQ Canadians. We also might talk about Russians or maybe about Chinese. And I think it's a very good thing because it should not be as a crusade against the United States. It should be a question asked to all these security services, because we all try to do the same.
So we need a Russian and a Chinese Snowden too, giving us all the documents?
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Wow. Unfortunately, we all understand the problems, and I told you before the interview that we had a very sad example when some people, instead of the Russian secret services, tried to launch Russian version of WikiLeaks, and they spectacularly failed because of lack of support from media, I mean Russian media. But nevertheless, we should try, and I think one day, I think we might get a very good debate about this problem.
That is one topic we've also covered before the interview. You are an investigative journalist, you bring up a lot of stories, but apparently you're not widely read in Russia.
Yeah, that's right. It seems that, because I'm not actually, I have no option to publish my stories in Russian media. I might publish some op-eds, some columns maybe, in some Russian sites. But since I was fired from Nova Gazeta, nobody tried to suggest me anything in Russian media. So it's a very awkward situation that you, on the one hand, you might publish something in the West, on the other hand, you see that your audience in your country is very limited.
Might that also be one reason for your relatively little pressure of the authorities in Russia?
That might be the case, but I would be extremely cautious talking about a little pressure, because everything is becoming very unpredictable now. 2 years ago, when we first met, I told you that it was impossible to prosecute a Russian journalist for, say, disclosing state secrets, because if you have no security clearance, you cannot disclose anything. Now it's all changed. Now we have new legislation, and now a journalist might be accused of treason just because he gave some information to, say, foreign organization. And now this information should not be necessarily state secret, and also even this foreign organization should not be necessarily a spying organization. Now it might be just a foreign organization. So it's all becoming more and more unpredictable.
So the situation we also got the blogger law last Tuesday, where blogs with over 3,000 daily visits must register as media. And we've learned about the internet censorship, and now also about new laws against journalists. So it seems the entire situation of media, of a public, and of journalists is going downhill in Russia. Only one direction.
Yeah, that's right, because what makes all things more depressing is that when we are talking about pressure on journalists, it's not only about the government pressure. We also should remember that the audience is not in support of journalists. Investigative journalists especially were compromised in the very early of 2000s. Mostly, well, to be frank, it was not only the problem of state propaganda, it also was because many journalists really accepted money, and this argument was just played very skillfully by the government. And that's why now the impression among many Russians is that investigative journalists are all corrupt. And of course it's not very helpful. But also you should understand that now Vladimir Putin enjoys almost complete support, and he enjoys something about 82% of popularity. And it's a crazy thing in terms of how you might be critical in such circumstances when 82% of the population support his policy.
So what does it mean for the future of a critical media, a critical public in Russia?
In long term, you see how it all developed. Like 7 years ago, we understood that investigative journalism is a red mark, was not allowed by authorities. And that's why new media, when we got some money and we were developing, and it was some sort of hope, I was very skeptical, because I saw that these new media were not allowed to hire investigative journalists. What we got now that now it's not only about investigations, it's also about reporting. During the Moscow protests of 2011-2012, some new media decided to hire reporters. So to turn themselves into from from news aggregator into something real, to have some real reporters who might go to the ground, to some regions like to Ukraine, and to report from there real stuff. And one of these new media, the most popular, which was called Atlanta.ru, was spectacularly pressured by, and the editor was fired, and the reporter, who was quite good, he was fired from this media just because of his reporting from Ukraine. So now you see how gradually it's all developed. So now it's not only about investigations, it's also about reporting. So the next step would be, I think, what we have left. We have critical comments. So maybe the next stage would be to prosecute people for expressing criticism. Even if it's not based on genuine, real information.
That seems like a bad outlook. Is there anything people in the West, people in Germany can do to support you?
No, I don't think so. I think it's the situation is quite desperate, because if you... Some months ago, maybe years, dream it of investigative center maybe in Moscow, some sort of media. But now I understand that it's absolutely impossible, because if this kind of organization would be, say, supported by the West, immediately these organizations would be branded as a spying organization. So it's not an option today.
Which is what Putin has been doing with all NGOs, basically, last
year. Absolutely, yeah, that's right. And actually, if you look into media landscape, you can see that there is no media funded by the West. It's just impossible. We have this Radio Freedom, of course, Radio Free Europe. But, well, because it's so tiny thing and nobody actually listens to them, so they are not prosecuted. But, in fact, I don't see that that anyone can... What actually might be done? Because you cannot. It's a very tricky thing when you have a leader who is so popular in his own country. What you can do?
That's a pretty dark outlook at the end of this podcast. We have anything to add to maybe? I don't know. Leave listeners thing. With a different.
Yeah, maybe one thing that we need to remember. Maybe I should. Well, it might be quite schizophrenic, but I'm not agree with my last argument. The problem is that, yes, this argument was made by many that, well, what you can do when Putin is so popular? And the problem is that he is so popular mostly because of the weakness of media. Because for many years, the media was so weak in exposing his corruption. So now, it's quite a crazy picture if you now... watch Russian TV and you see some story about, say, hear some story about corruption, it would be mostly about oligarchs of the 1990s. Wow, so many years passed. Why we don't hear about corruption of the oligarchs we got in the 2000s? But people still think about corruption in terms of things that actually happened 15 years ago. And that was very smart of Putin. And so the problem is that we are so... It's a political debate are so weak in our society that the Russian audience is not very actually ready for real political debate. So that's why they tend to accept very primitive ideas, like Crimea should be ours, Ukraine is not a real state, we should, well, they are all fascists. They just don't have this habit to be critical with the information. And we lost this thing thanks to Putin in the early 2000s, and we're still in the same situation. That's why the situation is quite desperate. It's not because I just try to say that it's not because we have this post-totalitarian society, or because we are Russians and it's always was Russian problem. I just try to mean that try to say that it was made deliberately by the Kremlin. And when you have no political debate in your society, inevitably you end up in such a situation. So, wow, political debate in a society is a very important thing.
Well, Andrei, thank you very much. It was really interesting. Thank you very much for the interview, and keep up the good work you're doing.
Thank you for having me.